Did you hear what they said? Did you hear what they said? Did you hear what they said? They said another brother's dead. They said he's dead, but he can't be buried. They said he's dead, but he can't be buried. Come on, come on, come on, come on. This can't be real. Did you hear what they said? Did you hear what they said? Did you hear what they said? They said they shot him in his head. Shot in the head to save his country. A shot in the head to save his country. Hey, come on, come on, come on, come on. This can't be real. Did you hear what they said? What they said about his mother and how she cried. They said she cried 'cause her only son was dead. They said she cried 'cause her only son was dead. Woman, could you
welcome to Great Speeches and Interviews on Access Sacramento and The Voice. I'm Steve Lerman. Today's program starts out with Living in a Police State. Paul Butler talks about how ordinary citizens interact with the justice system and examines the system's overall strengths and weaknesses. Paul was an ambitious federal prosecutor, a Harvard law grad, who gave up his corporate law salary to fight the good fight until one day he was arrested on the street and charged with a crime he didn't commit.
And we want to introduce you to Paul Butler, who is a professor of law at Georgetown University, a former prosecutor, and a former defense attorney. Mr. Butler, when you hear the term police state, what do you think? Is the U.S. a police state?
I think there are a lot of communities that would think so. You know, now we have one African-American president and 1 million African-American people in prison. 2.5 million altogether, way too many. The United States has 5% of the world's population and 25% of the world's inmates. So lots of us think we don't need that many people in prison to keep us safe. There are lots of folks from all over the political spectrum who have concerns. So if you're a civil libertarian, of course you think the government has way too much power. But if you're a fiscal conservative, you don't think it's cost effective to spend $25,000 a year, multiply that by 2.5 million people in prison. Peter, think of what else we could do with that money. We could use it for health care, for jobs training, for to improve our public schools. Faith-based conservatives think that people deserve a second chance. So when you look at how long sentences wages are in the United States, way longer than any other country, any other industrialized democracy. A lot of us think that we could do this a lot better. We could still be safe, we could spend less money, and we could make our communities whole.
How did we get to the point where we have that many people in prison?
It's politics mainly. It doesn't have anything to do with the crime rate. When crime goes up, we lock more people up. When the crime rate goes down, we lock more people up. When the crime rate stays the same, we lock more people up. It's really a result of policy incentives for the police to arrest more folks. They get more money from the federal government from doing that. It's also about the war on drugs. And we're learning now. We're seeing in places like Colorado and Washington that treatment works for drug users who become addicts. And for stuff that's more or less like alcohol, think marijuana, we really need to tax and regulate that, because the war on drugs and then these very harsh, excessive, draconian sentences for pretty much every crime have gotten us into this state.
So it's mainly drug laws?
Well, it's drug laws is one big component. So if we started using treatment rather than punishment, if we thought of the drug issue as a public health issue and not an issue that we can arrest and punish our way out of, we'd have more responsible policy. Now, we still have a whole lot of people in prison, and so for that, we need to start being smart on crime rather than tough on crime, and asking ourselves whether these draconian sentences for pretty much every crime, and there are 4,000 federal crimes alone. That's not even going into the state crimes, which are most crimes. 4,000 federal state crimes. Again, we can get Tea Party conservatives involved in this conversation because that's excessive government. We don't need Big Brother looking over that much of our lives.
In your book, Let's Get Free, A Hip-Hop Theory of Justice, you write, "What I am not saying, you are not saying. Prison should be abolished. People should not be held accountable for their actions. I don't believe that I have locked up thug. I don't believe that. I have locked up thugs I hope never see the light of day. I will never deny that society needs an official way to punish the bad guys. Otherwise, if somebody did the unthinkable, say, killed my loved one, I would kill him myself. The criminal justice system gives the state a monopoly on exercising that kind of retribution. It's legal hate."
Sure. So, Peter, I'm a former prosecutor. I became a prosecutor because I was that kind of nerdy kid who got my lunch money stolen from me when I was going to school in inner city Chicago, and I didn't like bullies. And I said, you know what? When I make it, as I hope I do, I'm going to try to make a difference for my community. And the way that I thought I could make a difference was to go in from the inside. Now, I knew the prosecutors had issues or that they worked a lot with police. And, you know, as a young black kid growing up in Chicago, I knew that the police weren't always my friends. So I thought I could kind of go in as this undercover brother from the inside, make a difference that way. So maybe I could get the police to treat people more fairly, but also really concerned about folks who are victims of crime. Remember one time, my mom, she was driving up to our house and some guys robbed her in her car. After that, she was afraid to go inside our house. She had to flag down a police car every time she got home to have them watch her go inside the house. So I think when folks are concerned about criminal justice reform, about being smart on crime, it's because we do care about victims. It's not only the guys who are at risk for going to prison whose lives we want to improve. We want to make it safe for people in the streets of Harlem, of Watts, and Anacostia. And again, the way to do that is, maybe this is surprising, but to stop locking up so many people. Because when you're locking up 2.5 million people, a lot of folks who are there are kids. They're nonviolent drug offenders. They're not menaces to society. But when you take a guy who's standing on the corner, you know, selling a dime bag and lock him up for 5 years with hardcore thugs, when he comes out, he's worse. He's not better. It's like sending him to finishing school for crime. So again, the way to get our community safer is to stop these draconian sentences and especially to end the failed war on drugs.
You write, "To live in a free country is to tolerate a minimum level of risk. We need to stop being so afraid." But what do you say to your mom if she can't walk into her house? How do you protect her?
I say, do you feel safe in this era now where we're locking up all these people? And again, if you ask young folks in Chicago, especially young African-American and Latino kids, do they feel safe? They would say, no, we're scared to walk to school every morning. And so clearly, locking up so many people, which is the way that we've been dealing with this problem, doesn't work. So we got to look at what makes folks at risk for committing violent crimes. And we know a lot of this. Some of this is you can't separate it from the school. So that's why I was so delighted yesterday to hear the president and the secretary of education and the attorney general talking about this school to prison pipeline, because they understand there's a connection between segregated, inferior, failing schools and who ends up in prison. So, you know, there's this urban myth that prison planners look at the number of black boys in third grade, and on that basis, they determine how many prison beds they're going to need in 20 years. That's not true, but it's one of those lies that gives us the truth, because you could kind of look and see what kids are messing up, what kids aren't doing well, and if we could do interventions, if we could get them the kinds of services that they need at an early age, we wouldn't have so many folks in prison, and so many folks like my mom scared to walk in their own neighborhoods.
Paul Butler, how did you get from the South Side of Chicago to Yale, Harvard, prosecutor, and defendant?
So shout out to my mom. I mean, I think she's the most important reason. Shout out to the Jesuits. I teach at Georgetown, a Jesuit institution, and I was lucky enough to go to a great Jesuit high school in Chicago called St. Ignatius College Prep. So that really got me steered on the right way. So I was kind of programmed. But, you know, there's not anything different about me. You know, I ended up at Yale. Some of my brothers who I grew up with ended up in jail. Not literal brothers, but they weren't real different from me. It's just that I got some lucky breaks. I had a mom who'd gone to college who knew the importance of education. You know, I had health care. I had the kinds of services that I need. And the important thing is that if we could get other kids, including the young men and women in Chicago who are in dire straits now, if we could get them the same quality education that I had, then just like me, they could end up in college, in law school, and here on C-SPAN talking to you.
Harvard Law, and then prosecutor.
Yeah, so I worked for a judge for a year. And in law school, I've been this kind of down-for-the-cause brother who no one thought would be a prosecutor. I think they would have predicted that I'd work for a civil rights organization or for legal aid. But even then, and this was in the 90s, you could see this massive human rights issue coming. And by massive human rights issue, I mean how many young black men were being punished. And again, I knew both sides. I say I became a prosecutor because I hated bullies. And I also say I stopped being a prosecutor because I hated bullies. Because every day I would stand up in that courtroom and I would say, ladies and gentlemen on the jury, my name is Paul Butler and I represent the United States. And I would use that awesome power to put black men in prison. And you know, this is in D.C. We call it a chocolate city. Most of the jurors at that time were African American. And these old black women and men on the juries, they would beam at me when I said I represented the United States, like they were thinking, you go, boy. You make us proud. And I didn't know if the best way to use the community's investment in me was to lock up so many people, especially when it didn't seem to be making a difference. So again, I say I stopped being a prosecutor also because I hated bullies. I had all this power, but I was using it against people who were basically pawns in a criminal justice system that had spun out of control.
He said, son, have you seen the world? Well, what would you say if I said that you could just carry this gun? You'll even get paid. I said, that sounds pretty good. Black leather boots, spit shine so bright. They cut off my hair, but it looks alright. We marched and we sang. We all became friends as we learned how to fight. A hero of war, yeah, that's what I'll be. And when I come home, they'll be damn proud of me. I'll carry this flag to the grave if I must, 'cause it's a flag that I love and a flag that I trust. I kicked in the door, I yelled my commands. The
Children, they cried, but I got my man. We took him away, a bag over his face, from his family and his friends. They took off his clothes, they pissed in his hands. I told them to stop, but then I joined in. We beat him with guns and batons, not just once, but again and again. A hero of war, yeah, that's what I'll be. And when I come home, they'll be damn proud of me. I'll carry this flag to the grave if I must, 'cause it's a flag that I love and a flag that I trust. She walked through bullets and haze. I asked her to stop, I begged her to stay, but she pressed on. So I lifted my gun and I fired away. And the shells jumped through the smoke and into the sand that the blood now had soaked. Collapsed with a flag in her hand, a flag white as snow. A hero of war, is that what they see? Just medals and scars, so damn proud of me. And I brought home that flag, now it gathers dust, but it's a flag. Son, have you seen the world? Well, what would you say if I said that you could?
And now back to Living in a Police State with Paul Butler.
Does the prosecutor side, in your view today, have too much power?
They have way too much power. So there's a Supreme Court case in which the government, the prosecutor, offered a plea bargain to this guy. They said it was a drug case. They said, if you plead guilty now, then we're just going to ask for 5 years. But if you elect your constitutional right to go to trial and you lose, we're going to throw the book at you and go for life imprisonment. So the guy thought, I have a constitutional right to a jury trial. I think I'm innocent. I'm going to take my chances. He lost, got life imprisonment. So he goes to the Supreme Court. Your Honors, there's no way this can be fair. The prosecutors give me either 5 years or life. The Supreme Court said that's totally constitutional. So that's what prosecutors do. That's why 97% of folks plead guilty. They're scared to death to go to trial because if they lose, the costs are too high.
In Let's Get Free, the U.S. has 5% of the world's population, 25% of its prisoners. There are 60% more people in U.S. prisons than in the U.S. military. The state of California alone has more prisoners than France, Great Britain, Germany, Japan, Singapore, and the Netherlands combined. In Baltimore, population 615,000, 115,000 people were arrested in 1 year. Under the law of 15 states, you can be sentenced to life imprisonment for a first-time nonviolent marijuana offense. By 2011, the number of Americans under criminal justice supervision will be nearly 8 million. In the U.S., one new prison or jail opens every week.
Yeah. So the good news is that we're getting a little bit better. So in the last couple of years, we're locking up fewer people. We're locking up fewer African-American folks, but that's a slow, gradual decline. In order to get us back to where the other industrialized nations of the world are, in order where we were back in the 70s, we'd have to let hundreds of thousands of people out of prison. And the thing is, Peter, we can actually do that. We've seen jurisdictions like California, and New York actually let folks out of prison safely, intelligently, decreased their prison populations. And guess what happened? Crime went down. Crime went down. So again, this is still the former prosecutor in me. I want folks to be safe. I want people to be secure in their homes, in their property. And part of the way we do that is to get smart on crime.
One of the stories that Paul Butler tells in Let's Get Free, A Hip-Hop Theory of Justice, is about his own arrest. If you want to hear about that, you can pick up the book and you can read about his own arrest and how that affected him. But you write, politics plays a role in whom prosecutors charge with crimes.
So, you know, everyone knows about this crack cocaine sentencing disparity. So it used to be that you got the same punishment for one unit of crack cocaine that you got for 100 units of powder cocaine. And chemically, they're indistinguishable. The way you make crack cocaine is you get some powder and some baking soda, you put it in the microwave, it comes out, it's crack. Why is there so much more punishment for crack? It's not because it's more dangerous. We don't know that. You know, the Senate had this hearing, actually it was the House had this hearing back in the 80s when a basketball player who was drafted by the Celtics, his name was Len Bias, he died. They thought, because he was black, that it was crack. Tip O'Neill was the Speaker of the House then. He said, you know what, I'm going to make this my issue. I think folks should get more punishment for crack. I think it should be 25-1. Republicans said, oh no, this is our issue. You're not tougher than we are, 50-1. Tip said, 75-1. That's how it got bid up to 100-1. There weren't any hearings about whether it's more dangerous. There weren't any hearings about what the effects of this kind of law would be. That's how criminal justice policy gets made. It's unfortunate. We need to have more intelligent policy.
Paul Butler is our guest. The phone numbers are on the screen, divided by political affiliation. If you'd like to join in our conversation about the U.S. justice system, go ahead and dial in now. And if you've had experience with the U.S. justice system as well, we'd like to hear from you. We're going to begin with a call from Paul in Macon, Mississippi. Paul, you're on the air. Go ahead.
Yes. Good morning.
Good morning.
Yes, what I got to say, you know, about Governor Chris Christie, he probably was a bully all his life growing up in the community, in high school. And there's a big thing on getting rid of bullies in high school. Why would put up with bullies in our political system? That's my comment.
That was Paul in Macon, Mississippi. What about bullies, Professor Butler?
You know, we have to be smart about the way that we deal with issues in high school. One concern now is that when we have these safety threats to schools and we respond by putting police officers in schools, then suddenly what used to be things that you got sent to the principal's office now you get arrested for. And it's really not everybody. It's mainly African-American kids and kids with disabilities. So this is one of the things that Attorney General Holder pointed out yesterday.
And now, messages from Access Sacramento.